Ladies and gentlemen, in the approximately 4 years that I've had the pleasure of presiding after fashion over some of the Keller Lecture exercises, I have been so much impressed by one thing in particular, which I would like to mention to this audience tonight, and I will be scolded for doing it, as I'm not supposed to do this exactly, but because one of my good associates is to have the honor of introducing the speaker tonight, I would like to say this right here and now, that the contribution of the Keller Lectures to the University of Hartford's program is perfectly remarkable. And I would like to pay tribute to one lady for whom I have formed the highest admiration and the greatest affection, the sponsor of this series, Mrs. Alexander Keller herself, not just because she is a charming person and of great skill in the planning of these series over the years, but because of her tremendous ability to secure for us the outstanding speakers really in the world. I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, who else could procure for us in the course of one season? And I wish I could say it were wholly the prestige of the University of Hartford which drew them here. This day will come, is coming, partly through this influence, but it hasn't yet come to this point. No, mostly through personal persuasion and a dedication to getting a wonderful job done, has Mrs. Keller this year brought to us and to you Dr. Archibald MacLeish, Dr. Harlow Shapley, and tonight Sir Isaiah, who anywhere could possibly have done better. A salute, please, to Mrs. Keller. The speaker tonight will be presented to you by my associate, Professor Henry Grattan, associate professor of English at the University of Hartford, a doctor of philosophy from Yale, a former member of the faculty of Mount Holyoke and of Hobart College, a gentleman whose company we have greatly enjoyed since he has been on our campus, and who has served as chairman of the faculty committee on the Keller Lectures with great distinction and great success, Professor Grattan.
Sir Isaiah Berlin, Mr. Chancellor, Mrs. Keller, students and faculty of the university, ladies and gentlemen, we learned from a recent issue of a weekly news magazine that on an evening just before Christmas, Sir Isaiah Berlin sat in front of a fireplace in the White House and spoke to a small group of our governors, including the president, about the Russian novel. All Souls, Oxford, of which Sir Isaiah is a fellow, has many fireplaces, some big ones and very many tiny grates. And in the shadows cast by the flames of the coal that burns in them, for many generations, men of great distinction and influence in England, prime ministers, churchmen, authors, soldiers, and sometimes unclassifiable heroes have come, especially over the weekends, to talk with and listen to the scholars All Souls nurtures. Here we have no fireplace. We are not in the White House, although to be sure, we are in a school named for an authentic American king. Nor is the University of Hartford, Oxford. Not yet, I mean. Nevertheless, these Keller lectures, the speakers for which have been chosen now for 6 years, with such intelligence, courage, and taste by Mrs. Keller, make the university and the town proud. They point a way in which an urban university can fecundate its surroundings with interest in knowledge, just as the coming of the scholars to Oxford in the 12th century changed that town from a mere river crossing to one of the famous, one of the world's famous cities of light. Tonight, the Chicherley Professor of Social and Political Theory at Oxford is going to speak to us. And I may add that this lecture will be broadcast tomorrow night at 10:05 o'clock over WTIC. And furthermore, our speaker will respond to questions from persons in the audience at the end of the evening, this evening. Sir Isaiah has written a great deal. He is a wonderful writer. He can show in a flash the affinities between opposites, Virginia Woolf and Tolstoy, for instance. And then he can turn at just the right moment from public events to inner conflicts, of which he has the most subtle understanding. His subject this evening is Romanticism, Politics, and Ethics. I do not know at all what he is going to say about the effect upon us of Romanticism, that paradoxical complex of feeling that bequeathed us, on the one hand, modern nationalism, and on the other, a certain rueful anti-industrialism. But we can be certain of his concern with the ultimate problems which, as he says in his book on the historical philosophy of Tolstoy, The Hedgehog and the Fox, face young men in every generation, namely, good and evil, the origin and purpose of the universe and its inhabitants, the causes of all that happens. Ladies and gentlemen, Sir Isaiah Berlin.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid the compliments paid to me are more than my due, but it's much nicer getting more than one's due than merely one's due, and for this I'm most grateful. I'd like to begin with one apology, so to speak, and that is this. I'm afraid I speak rather fast in a low voice, and it's quite possible that people at the back of the room may not be able to hear clearly or understand. If they can't hear, and if nevertheless they wish to hear, and on that assumption alone, I should be grateful if they behaved in some mildly eccentric fashion. That is to say, if they lifted their hands or shuffled their feet or did something to attract my attention, in which case I shall do my best to proceed more loudly and more slowly. I can't promise to succeed, but at least I can try. The subject of this lecture, which is Romanticism, Politics, and Ethics, is really an attempt on my part to clarify something which has long fascinated me, namely, that I think that somewhere in the middle of the 18th century, there was a change of attitudes on the part of human beings in the Western world, which really transformed both political and ethical views to a far deeper and more revolutionary extent than is usually supposed. The subject is not merely of historical interest, because it seems to me that in the present age we have inherited the consequences of this turnover, and it has made a difference to what people feel at present, and both to modes of thought and modes of action, far more dramatic and catastrophic than is usually stated in books of history or in books of the history of thought. It isn't very often that large shifts of consciousness occur among human beings. When I speak of shift of consciousness, I don't mean new answers to old problems. Newton gave new answers to old problems about the nature of the universe, but the problems, so to speak, remained the same. They didn't alter. Merely far better answers were produced, with a consequent alteration in, for example, the attitude towards the external world and the birth of certain new natural sciences. When I speak of a shift of thought, I mean that the whole attitude towards the world, the concepts and the categories, in terms of which people think, are in some extraordinary way transformed, so that old questions are not answered, but disappear. New questions appear, and questions which appeared of urgent importance before suddenly become dissipated and can scarcely be understood. I don't wish to enlarge upon this because it would take me too long, but it's something to do with the fact that human beings think in terms of some sort of models. To explain something to yourself is usually to try and think of it as being like something else. When people ask central questions in politics and ethics, for example, why should anybody obey anybody else, rather than, for example, disobey them, which is perhaps the central question in politics, or what are rights, or what is liberty, or what are the purposes of life, or more specific questions such as are republics better than monarchies, or what does it mean to say that there are natural rights as against artificial rights, and questions of that type which are traditional in politics. When people ask those sort of questions, the tendency is to try and answer them in terms of something more familiar. For example, in Plato's day, there was an attempt to explain the nature of society by analogies with, say, geometry, about which something was known. Aristotle tried analogies with biology. Other people at later dates tried analogies with, for example, the law, and so we get theories of social contract. Or you said, no, this is not right. Relationships between human beings are not like relationships between persons governed by the same laws. They are more like relationships, say, between members of a family. And so other theories sprang up to explain that relations of people in society are more like relations between brothers and sisters than they are between, let us say, a man who sells a house and a man who buys a house. This, again, in its turn, although it cast a certain amount of light upon what it was, that which it was meant to explain, turned out again to be some kind of straitjacket, and people felt that also to be inadequate in some way. And so new models spring up, and you say, no, it's not like this, it's more like that. It's not like a family, it's rather more like something else. Let us say, more like the relations of the state and its citizens is more like, say, the liberal theory. The state is really as a kind of policeman. All it's meant to do is to prevent collisions and to look after property. And then other people said it can't be simply a policeman. We feel a certain amount of loyalty to the state. Nobody feels loyalty to policemen, and so on. And the whole history of human thought is really an attempt to use one model after another for the purpose of elucidating something which appears to be obscure. When a big model disappears or crumbles or is felt to be in some way unilluminating, and some other model in some way takes its place, a large shift in consciousness occurs. It seems to me that something of this kind occurred in the middle of the 18th century, and that this has made an enormous difference to thought and feeling. Now, let me be more specific. Until, roughly speaking, in the middle of the 18th century, from, say, Plato onwards, for something like more than 2,000 years, certain assumptions were made about human behavior of a very simple kind. People thought, first of all, that questions of how to live and what to do were capable of true answers. Like any other questions, if you said, why should we live like this rather than like that, someone must have the answer. there were a great many differences about what the answer was. And there were a great many differences about who knew the answer. Some people thought that the answer, for example, was discovered by, let us say, the priests, that it was to be found, say, in certain sacred writings, or in the interpretation of those writings by accredited churches. Other people said that the answers were to be discovered in laboratories by scientists, because, let us say, God doesn't exist, there is only a thing called nature, which is mechanical in character. Some people thought that the answers could be discovered only by certain experts who were good at finding out this kind of thing. Others said, on the contrary, any man, by looking within his heart, can discover the answer. There are no moral or political specialists. There may be specialists in physics, there may be specialists in geography, but on matters of conduct, questions like what kind of life should we live, what is justice, what are rights, what is the proper form of human government, any man, any rational man, is in principle able to discover the answer if his mind is not beclouded by ignorance and prejudice. Again, there might be divisions of opinion about the types of questions these questions are. People try to distinguish questions of fact from questions of value. But throughout this period, for over 2,000 years, there was a general assumption that just as questions of fact could be answered in certain obvious ways. If you ask the question, how tall is this tree, you could measure it. If you ask the question, how far is Constantinople from Timbuktu, you didn't know, but you knew how it could be discovered or who the proper experts were whom you could ask. So in the case of the questions of politics and ethics also. Well, how should we live? What is right? What is good? What is freedom? Why is it desirable? Why is freedom better than slavery? Why is justice better than injustice? Why is equality better than inequality, and so on? That to these questions also there must be some kind of true answers which somebody or other must be able to find out. Now, again, you might say men were too stupid ever to find this out for themselves. You might say that there was original sin by which we would never discover the answer completely. You might say, we don't know it now, but we knew it once upon a time when there was a golden age. But then there was a fall, men fell into sin, and they no longer know the answer. Or you might say, we don't know yet, but a golden age is to come, one day we shall know. You might say, we don't know this on earth, but we shall know it in heaven. But somewhere there must be an answer, somebody knows. If we don't know, our successors will know. If we don't know, at any rate, God knows. Somebody knows there is an answer. Because if there isn't an answer, then the question is not a question. There is something wrong, it's just a neurosis in that case. Some kind of malaise on the part of human beings. A real question must be capable of having one true answer, all the other answers being false. This seems very simple, and it's certainly the foundation of what might be called Western thought. And since this is one of the most, perhaps the most important question affecting human lives, bloody wars were fought by people who adopted different answers. Those who thought that the answer lay in the Catholic Church were presumably dissatisfied with those who thought that the answer lay in the individual conscience. And so wars of religion were fought. Those who believed that the answer lay in the laboratory were displeased with those who thought that the answer was metaphysical or theological or given only revealed to mystical persons in moments of unique revelation and so forth. But there was no doubt on either side of the fight. Even when wars were fought and people burnt each other, there was no doubt that all these persons believed that there was an answer, only the enemy whom you were about to burn or destroy simply got it wrong, and not only got it wrong, but poisoned other persons into a similar condition of ignorance or error. Now, one of the corollaries, let me tell you, the three propositions upon which the Western tradition rested were, firstly, that to moral and political questions there exist objective answers, which are in some sense capable of being formulated. Secondly, that human beings to some degree are able to obtain these answers, either privileged human beings or all human beings, but somebody at any rate. And thirdly, that the answers cannot be incompatible with each other. It is clear that if a true answer to one moral question and a true answer to another moral question must be compatible, because one truth, for logical reasons, cannot be incompatible with another. Now, if you could discover all the true answers, perhaps you won't be able to for various reasons, because, as I say, you were too ignorant, or because it was too difficult, or because the questions are too complex, or whatever it may be. But if you could only discover all the true answers and put them together, this would constitute a kind of global answer to the question how life should be lived. It was a kind of jigsaw puzzle. If only you could put the bits together, there would be a kind of total answer, some kind of pattern, along which life could be arranged. And if you could arrange life along that, then men would be happy and just and prosperous and truthful and free forever. And this was what was meant by saying that there was some kind of objective ideal towards which it was worth striving, which was presumably the same for all men everywhere at all times, because what is true must be true eternally and must in fact be both objective and capable of being known. These three legs of this particular stool, if you like, these three propositions on which whatever the acute disagreements, although they may have been divided by enormous differences, metaphysically, theologically, in every way, these three propositions are common, I would aver, to the Western tradition. These three propositions were, to some degree, shattered by the Romantic movement. And this is what created an immense and revolutionary change in our whole mentality. Let me enlarge a little bit upon what these answers really mean. Take, for example, the 18th century, the Age of Reason, as it's sometimes called. People who were impressed by the work of Newton, who, after all, had managed with extraordinary genius to discover certain very few, very clear propositions from which you could deduce by perfectly intelligible, logical methods the position and movement of every particle in the universe. People were impressed by this stupendous achievement. Suppose that you could really do the same thing in the moral and political world as well. After all, what was the problem? The problem was to find out what to do. Now, in order to do, the problem was to find out how men should live. All you needed to do was simply to ask yourself, what did men crave for? You had to determine what human nature was. This could be determined in exactly the same way as you determine the nature of a tree or a stone or a lizard or any other object in nature. Having determined what human nature was by observation, by anthropology, by sociology, by all the methods open to the sciences, you then simply had to find out what this nature would be strengthened by, what it craved for, what it needed. After you discovered what it needed, you then had to discover how to produce it, how to procure it, how to provide it. And this, after all, was simply the task of the sciences. All you needed to know was what men wanted and then how to give it to them. And this was the ideal of the rationalists in the 18th century. The only thing to do was to avoid error. Theologians, metaphysicians had simply made mistakes about human nature. They said there was an immortal soul. There is no immortal soul. They said the world was created in a certain given year. It was not. It was created in some quite different fashion. They maintained that there were certain acts, for example, self-immolation or asceticism, which were human duties, but by examining human nature in a sane, scientific, anthropological fashion, by seeing how human beings behaved in China, in Peru, in Iceland, in Italy, in England, in Kamchatka, wherever it is, you would discover this was in fact not that which human nature craved for. If you could find out what beavers and bees wanted, you could all equally find out what human children or women or men or redskins or blackskins wanted. Once you discovered that, your morals and your politics could be put on a sound scientific basis. All that was necessary then was to make the right inventions, for which genius, of course, would be wanted, for the purpose of giving people what they needed: food, shelter, liberty, an organization in which they would obtain least friction, maximum happiness, and all the rest of it. This is the point of view which was shattered, as far as politics and ethics is concerned, by the Romantics of whom I'm about to speak. The thing started in a comparatively innocent fashion. The chief culprit in this particular story is that very unromantic, severe, schoolmaster-like figure of Immanuel Kant, who certainly had no notion of what the consequences of his particular propositions were likely to be. And without involving you in a lengthy lecture on moral philosophy, which I have no wish to give you, let me just say this. One of the things which Kant most deeply stressed was the fact that if a man was truly to be called moral, then what he does must be an act of free choice on his part. That is to say that a man is moral is to say that he clearly and consciously chooses to do X rather than Y. Because if choice is unreal, if men are determined, if I choose as I choose because the molecules in my body are such that I cannot help acting as I do, if I do what I do because the climate in which I live, and the soil on which I live, and the circulation of my blood, the condition of my liver, and other natural factors make it absolutely inevitable that I shall behave as I do in the sort of way in which certain behaviorists in the 18th century were liable to say men behaved. If this is true, then there was no value in anybody's choice. I can't help acting as I do. I'm an object in nature. Just as stones and trees were subject to rigid causality, if men were equally subject to it, then there was no point in praising and blaming people for doing or avoiding things which they couldn't help doing or avoiding. Therefore, the center of his position was that what we call morality is the fact that a man chooses what he does freely and openly, and that he chooses and is not chosen for, that he is the author of his own acts. This is a very central proposition in him. Because if I choose what I do simply because I'm overcome by passion, then I'm behaving like an object. I'm simply caused to act as I do, and I'm not being free. If I do as I do because I'm under the spell of emotions, because some psychologists could predict how I was likely to behave from examining me in the way in which physicists examine stones or zoologists examine horses, then it made no sense to say that certain acts were right, other acts were wrong, some were praiseworthy, some were blameworthy, which is a proposition which we all believed. From this, it followed for him that the most important thing in human beings was this capacity for freely choosing evil as well as good. It was only creditable to choose good because we deliberately refrained from evil. If we couldn't help refraining, there was nothing especially praiseworthy about choosing what was good. And this is really the heart of Kant's philosophy. The thing which he really keeps on stressing is that men create their own values. Because men create their own values, they follow these values because they freely choose them. We live the lives we live because we determine ourselves to do it freely, but we might have chosen otherwise. If this is really true, then to use other people as means, that is to say, to be paternalistic, to give people what you think is good for them, without putting them in a position where they can freely choose that which they want, to treat grown-up human beings as children, for example. That is the most heinous of all crimes which human beings can commit. Kant, no doubt, like other moralists, disapproved of cruelty or injustice or other things which are regarded as vices. But far more than cruelty or injustice did he disapprove of something which he regarded as the most monstrous of all possible human attitudes, which is degradation or humiliation of other human beings. To treat other human beings as means for your ends, to put other human beings into a condition of some kind of slavery, to use them for the purpose of obtaining not the ends which they were entitled to choose freely, but the ends which you chose and which you in some way conditioned them into being means for. Hence, the whole of Kant's rhetoric is directed against people who in some way get at other people who somehow condition other people who in some way, what is nowadays called brainwashing, so to speak, people who in some way treat other people as being unequal to themselves, as being mere instruments of their desires, because that, for him, dehumanizes them. What is human in human beings is this unique capacity for choosing, which is what material objects and animals lack. Now, if this is so, then, of course, the central quintessence of being a human being lies in the fact that you choose certain values, and that is why you must not, as a human being, be sacrificed to anything other than what you yourself choose. There is this great doctrine in the 18th century, which you find in Rousseau and in Kant, that unless I am governed by laws which I impose on myself, I am a slave. This is quite different from previous views. You see, previously you thought that the moral laws which you ought to obey were objective, something created by God or something created by nature, something which I discover out there in exactly the same way as I discover trees or stones or anything else which is out there. The thing to follow were some kind of objective principles which exist whether I know them or not. In the 18th century, you first get this note by which you say, freedom consists in obeying laws which I impose upon myself. And there is a real break here between people who think real laws are laws which I do not invent, but which are out there whether I see them or not, and the attitude which says, if I obey laws which are not of my own making, which are of somebody else's making, then in some sense I am a slave. Hence the whole doctrine of democracy on the part of these thinkers who say, I must participate in making the laws which I obey, because if I don't participate in making them, then they're imposed upon me from outside and I'm being treated as an object. I'm being treated as a thing. I'm pushed around. And this is the most ultimate degradation and humiliation, is the denial of man's humanity. It's the worst and most dreadful thing which any human being could do to another. This is the heart of the whole of the what might be called the moral democratic doctrine upon which modern democratic states rest. If it were left there, perhaps it wouldn't matter very much. Perhaps we could all accept that to some degree. But Kant's more romantic followers, to whom I come in a moment, developed this doctrine in a direction which Kant would certainly have abhorred, but which I think perhaps was in some sense inevitable. Kant talked about moral imperatives, which you discovered by looking within your own breast, so to speak, certain orders, which are not really true or false, simply commands which told you to act like this or like that, which issued from yourself to yourself. He called them rational. He said they bound all men equally. But for his followers, something else followed. If it was really true that choosing, freedom, was the essence, was the heart of man, then might it not be the case that values were something which human beings, so far from finding them scattered about the universe like stars out there, whether we recognize them or not, might it not be that values were much more like something which I invent myself? Let me make this a little clearer. Take the concept of nature, which I think is central here. The ordinary thinkers of the 18th century look upon nature as something to be imitated. Nature is a kind of model. There is this beautiful, divine harmony. In the Middle Ages, it's a kind of natural hierarchy with God at the top and the amoeba below. And the important thing is to discover where I belong in this natural hierarchy, which I haven't made, but to which I belong. And if only I can discover where I belong in this pyramid and proceed to function accordingly, then I shall be happy, I shall be just, I shall be good, because that's what I was made for by God or by nature. In the 18th century, you don't get the notion of hierarchy because they deny that there is, so to speak, some kind of great metaphysical structure, which arose, I think, largely as a result of a combination of Greek and Christian theologies in some ways. But still, the notion of nature is very paramount. You get a lot of statements about dame nature, mistress nature. Nature is conceived of either as a tyrant which forces you to do certain things, or as a kind of kindly mother whose voice you must listen to. If only you would look at the way in which nature does things, if only you would sit in some quiet glade and observe cows browsing and streams flowing instead of involving yourself in the corrupt life of sophisticated cities, according to Rousseau. If only you did that, you would discover that there is a great natural harmony around you, and if only you could adjust yourself to this great natural harmony, you would be fulfilling your human nature in a way in which it was intended that it should be fulfilled. Intended by whom? Well, if you were a deist, you believed in God. If you were an atheist, you said nature. But in all these cases, there is some kind of purpose here, which you can only discover, which is a purpose which is there whether you know it or not. And the important thing is to discover what this purpose is. Once you discover this purpose, you can switch yourself into the mechanism, so to speak. You can adjust yourself to this objective harmony, and then all goes well, because all pain, all suffering, all tragedy comes from not understanding where you really belong. You are really born to be a flute player, let us say, and you insist on playing the violin. If you are born to play a flute player, then you will play the violin badly, you will be unhappy, you will interfere with the rest of the orchestra, things will go well badly both for them and for you. The important thing is, so to speak, to discover what it was that you were meant to do. And if only you could discover by some kind of inspection, some people said by metaphysical means, some people said by through the laboratory, by anthropology and sociology, others used other methods, but if only you could discover in the proper way what it was that you are, what part you are meant to play in the orchestra, which is a kind of typical simile or metaphor used at that time, if only you could discover, then you would discover that you wanted, the flute was really the instrument for you. And then if you played the flute, you would be realized, the rest of the orchestra would play in harmony with you, and all would be well. This is the notion. With Kant, you really get something very different. If the important thing is choice, if the value of a man's act consists in the fact that he freely determines himself in a certain direction, whereas he might have determined himself otherwise, and the value resides not in the fact that he gets things right, but in the fact that he chooses freely, then nature ceases to be a model, ceases to be something which you have to imitate, have first of all to find out about, describe to yourself, and then ask yourself, where do I come in? What is my particular function or part in this particular play, so to speak? What you then do is you look upon nature as so much raw material which you mold consciously to your own self-conceived purposes. And so nature ceases to be a model and becomes a kind of challenge. Nature ceases to be a kind of pattern which you try and adjust yourself to, and becomes simply so much raw material, almost hostile, a sense of slag heap, a mass of stuff, which you consciously mold into the pattern which you freely determine yourself. Because if you don't freely determine yourself, then you are to that extent not being a moral being. And this is a tremendous shift. Now, with the notion that nature is no longer something to be imitated, you slowly get another notion growing up, which is, so to speak, what I tried to speak about at the beginning, which is a replacement of one model by another. In earlier times, you said, the scientists of the 18th century said, nature is nothing but one vast mechanism, and what exactly like a machine. And the thing to do is to find out which particular cog, which particular wheel or lever you are in it, or you or your society, your church, your nation, your race, your profession, whatever it might be. Others were dissatisfied with the notion of mechanism and talked, let us say, about organism. And they said that the relations of men to one another were different from the relations of cogs or wheels and more like the relations of, say, hands and feet and heart and liver and brain in the human body. Whichever, some thought one analogy was better, others another, and gave reasons for it and so on. But all this presupposes that you have to indulge in some kind of investigation. You have to find out where you are. Knowledge is the important thing. What you must do is find out what the world is like. And then you must adjust yourself to the world. You must find out what reality is like. The doctrine from Plato onwards is you'd better know what reality is like. Because if you don't know what reality is like, you will act in some mistaken fashion and then reality will get you in the end. The danger always is, so to speak, that you will somehow make a mistake. Tragedy. The whole idea of tragedy is error. Maybe inevitable error because you are too stupid to get out of the way or because the malicious gods play tricks on you. Maybe you can't help yourself. But tragedy always arises from the fact that people do not act in the way in which they might have acted if only they had acted in a way to harmonize with other people. The important thing is knowledge. And the people to respect and to admire are the people who get things right, the sages. The sage might be a scientist or he might be a priest. But the worship and the respect is always for the man who knows what things are like and adjusts himself accordingly. With Kant and his successors, this alters. The new model is a model much more of the arts than it is of the sciences, and this really is a great shift. The notion suddenly is freedom, spontaneity, self-determination. Is not life more like a work of art than it is like simply the succession of cause and effect in nature? Cause and effect in nature are a kind of inexorable mechanical process. If men are simply made to do what they do by being caused to act as they do by the composition of their blood or by the climate or by the society in which they live or by their institutions or by other causes, then there is no sense in telling human beings that they are free or that they have duties or they have ideals or anything of the kind. This is only true if they are not wholly, at least, determined by their environment, are not wholly objects being played upon by forces which they cannot control. Now, the great analogy, the so to speak, most characteristic human activity which these people could think of, which in some sense involved you in a free choice, was the activity of the creative artist. Take, for example, this analogy. Supposing I ask the question of an artist, where is the symphony before the composer has composed it? Where is the picture before the painter has painted it? Well, according to theories of people like Plato, there is, of course, some kind of divine archetype. There is something which he has to copy, something which he has to reproduce. There is some divine original somewhere which the artist somehow tries to make concrete here on earth. But by the time you get to the late 18th century, this is no longer the view. Where is the symphony before the composer has composed it? Nowhere is the answer. Where is the dance before the dancer has danced it? Where is the walk before I've walked it? It's apparently an idiotic question. The walk before I've walked it is not anything. The walk is the walking. The symphony is the composition. The painting is, in some sense, the result of, or the content of, the act of painting. Men are not objects. Men are continuous activities of some sort. In some sense, they are, so to speak, actors in committing themselves to certain courses of action. Now, if you say, where is the symphony before the composer has written it, and you say, not anywhere, then you say, well, what is this process then? What is the symphony? The symphony is an invention. Now, the difference between invention and discovery is of great importance. Previously to the moment of which I speak, which is the last third of the 18th century, which is the origin of the Romantic movement for these purposes, previously to that, The whole emphasis lay upon the fact that out there, there are truths, and it's very important to discover them. That there is a structure of reality, a rerum natura, which some people are better at finding out about than others. And if only you can find out what this rerum natura is, for example, that God exists or doesn't exist, that things have purposes or do not have purposes, that human beings need this or want this or want that, or are made happy by this or are made unhappy by that. If only you can discover that, then and then only will you be all right, so to speak. Now, there might be tremendous differences. Some people maintain that there are certain moral and political truths which are good for all men everywhere at all times, which is called the doctrine of natural law. Others deny this and say what is good for Persians is not good for Parisians. What is good for persons in the 17th century is not necessarily good for people in the 19th century. Montesquieu, Hume, relativists, subjectivists simply deny the proposition that there were certain universal principles of eternal validity, timeless and forever true, which apply to all men everywhere at all times. But still, even they, even these skeptics and these subjectivists, did maintain that if you studied what your condition was like in Persia in the 18th century, you could at least discover what it was that would make the Persians happy or prosperous or wise or just. And if you asked about the Peruvians in the 13th century, you could discover what would be good for the Peruvians. What was good for the Peruvians is not necessarily good for the Chinese. But something is good for the Peruvians, something is good for the Chinese, and these things do not necessarily clash. So that even the subjectivists, even people like Hume, who said, don't look outside for values. Values are simply subjective inclinations, more like tastes, more like subjective desires, simply invited you, instead of examining some imaginary outer realm to discover what the principles of action should be, invited you to use psychology instead. When you say something is good, you really mean that you like it or that you're in favor of it. Well, in that case, we have to have competent field psychologists to find out what most Englishmen of the 18th century would be made happy by, or what most Chinese in the 18th century would prefer. But this is discoverable. These are truths. You can find out the facts, and once you find out the facts, you can act upon it. Now, if it is the case that values are not discoverable at all, that they're much more like something made, not found, but made, not discovered, but invented, then the whole picture changes. And you get this romantic model which says life is much more like art than it is like nature. That is to say, if we say what is good, good is that which human beings make out of their lives. Good is that towards which human beings direct their lives. What are these things to which human beings direct their lives? These things are what human beings invent for themselves. These values are precisely human because people needn't follow them, and follow them because they invent them for themselves. Fichte, I suppose, the German philosopher Fichte, was perhaps the most consistent articulator of this particular doctrine, but it's to be found among almost every romantic of this particular age. Now, let me tell you about some of the peculiar consequences of this. For example, the notion of idealism. I don't mean idealism in the philosophical sense, I mean idealism in the common or garden sense, which you say so-and-so is very idealistic, or some human beings are more idealistic than others. Idealism, which is such a very common word and people use it all the time now, let me tell you, is something which would have been unintelligible before 1750, literally unintelligible. That is what I mean by saying that something large happened, that a whole new cluster of, so to speak, ideals, a whole new attitude to life came into being then, however it may have done so. Let me give you an illustration of what I mean. When we say somebody's idealistic, what we usually mean is we don't know whether we approve of his views or not, but we admire very much that he's prepared to sacrifice his life, his health, his wealth, everything about him for the purpose of following some disinterested purpose, even though we may disapprove of this purpose. We think there is something noble, something admirable about a man who determines himself, who is prepared to, so to speak, give everything he has towards the realization of some ideal within him, of some goal which burns within him with a sacred flame. Now, let me give you an example. If, for example, you took the 17th century wars of religion and you said to a Catholic, it is true that the Protestants believe what is false, but one must admit that they believe it with such integrity, such devotion, they give up everything for it, they're prepared to face the stake. This surely is a very admirable thing. This would not have been intelligible to anybody. On the contrary, the more violently you believe what is false, the more dangerous you are, the madder you are, the more you are likely to poison others. if you are a Christian knight fighting against the infidel, and you kill the infidel, if you are at all a human being, if you have decent human properties, you don't spit on his corpse. But you don't say to yourself, it's true that he believes terrible mumbo jumbo, but how wonderful to believe it with such conviction. How wonderful to believe it with such passion. It's exactly like as you would say now, here is a man who believes twice two is seven. Or here is a man who believes all grass is red. It's true, he hasn't been paid to do it. He really does believe that twice two is seven. Nobody has bribed him to say grass is red. Isn't it marvelous to have a man who is prepared to stake his all on the proposition that grass is red and twice two is always seven? On the whole, if a man did that, you would think him mad. Not at all worthy of your commendation. Not at all dignified, not at all. Well, in the 17th century and before the 18th century, this was undoubtedly the case in the case of religious convictions too, because you really thought there was a truth there somewhere. And if there was a truth, then to believe in falsehood was not at all, was not a profitable thing. To believe in falsehood was in no way dignified, in no way worthy, and if you believed in the falsehood with absolute fanaticism, it merely meant that you were particularly dangerous and particularly insane and particularly worthy of burning. It would have been no good saying to the Pope that what John Huss believed, he really believed very sincerely. It was no good saying to Calvin that what Servetus believed, he believed very sincerely. The sincerer they were, the more dangerous they were, the wickeder they were, the more deeply plunged into error they were. The important thing was to get things right. And anything which stops you from getting things right, particularly if you were fanatically convinced of it, was bad, not good. Now, by the time you get to the 19th century, this is not at all the case. By the time you get to the 19th century, if you have two men, for example, who believe opposite things, supposing they are both affected by the Romantic movement, if you have two men who believe opposite things and these things are not compatible, it's thought to be far nobler for one of these men to kill one of the other men in a duel, say. Either for A to kill B or for B to kill A, and best of all for both to kill each other, far better than the most infamous of all solutions, which is some feeble compromise. The one thing which is not allowed is that people shall jeopardize their convictions. I mean, they shall compromise their convictions. What is disgusting and thought of with extreme horror and nausea is the thought that in order to preserve your miserable life, you are prepared to admit or prepared anyhow to live as if what you knew to be true wasn't true. Far better that you should lose your life for what you believe, no matter what the odds, than that you should arrive at some squalid compromise simply for the contemptible purpose of preserving peace and order. This is the typical romantic attitude. And so you have a whole new cluster of values, which I don't think would have meant very much to men of the previous period. For example, integrity. Integrity is not something which anyone talks about before a certain date. For example, the whole worship of minorities, martyrdom, by which we say failure is in many ways nobler than success. The sort of typical holy figure of this particular period is someone like, let us say, Beethoven. Beethoven is a man who is sitting in a garret. He is allowed to be dirty, unkempt, rude, ignorant, and barbarous. The only thing which he is not allowed to do is to sell out. The one thing which he mustn't do is to not obey the inner voice which speaks to him for the sake of popular applause, popularity, money, or any of the other wicked kind of temptations which he has to resist. Otherwise, it doesn't matter what he is. The whole figure of the lonely artist, for example, the poor, unkempt, dirty, rude artist sitting in a garret by himself, who has special rights, who is a kind of sacred object, because he has dedicated himself to a purpose within him, even if you disapprove of the purpose, even if you are not interested in the purpose itself, that is something brand new. And new concepts of this degree of power and influence are comparatively rare in the history of nations. You have a whole cluster of virtues, as I say. The whole idea, for example, of fighting no matter what the odds, that it's somehow nobler to perish in a battle when you know that you're going to be defeated in a kind of quixotic way. Better to do that than to calculate the odds and say, after all, if I'm dead, I shan't be able to do anything at all. Therefore, better not be dead. This, so to speak, is relatively new. Now, during the previous period, this could never have been said. The important thing was to get things right. The important thing was to find out what the universe was like and then adjust yourself to it and be happy and be strong and be successful. The idea that failure is in some ways better than success is surely something very new. The whole worship of failures, minorities, and martyrs. The idea that martyrs and minorities are somehow more sacred than the big battalions is something comparatively new. Again, you get the notion, for example, that motive is more important than consequence. You see, you can't guarantee that you'll be happy because that depends on external factors. If the whole moral value of an act depends on what you yourself can do on your free act of choice. The only thing you can be responsible for is your own motive. You can't be responsible for the consequence. Therefore, happiness is not a worthy ideal, not so much because it isn't desirable in itself, as because you can't guarantee it. And since it's part of the external world, it isn't part of the proper moral effort of a man. All that you can be responsible for is that you will be pure in heart, that your motive will be sincere. What the consequences are is not in your power. And so you get moral judgments no longer in terms of consequences, which certainly was the case before, but for someone like Aristotle, for everyone who followed, by which you said the important thing is that human beings should achieve certain things. It doesn't matter what, I mean, works of art, certain political establishments, the victory of the church, whatever it might be, the important thing is to succeed. Failure is never, so to speak, valuable in itself. You now say, provided the heart is pure, provided the motive is good, provided he doesn't sell out, provided he's dedicated, provided he's completely free from any thought of betrayal, that is what gets you to heaven. Now, this, of course, in a sense, arises out of Christianity, but it's a secularized form of it. You see, Christianity and all religions, in a sense, were in favor of martyrdom, but then you were a martyr to the truth. The important thing was you died for something which was true, which is the most important thing in the world, because it was true, and therefore salvation lay in it. The idea that it was right to be a martyr for something which might be true or might be false, but the value of which was that you chose it, that it happened to be an ideal which you yourself dedicated yourself to, no matter what anybody else thought, no matter whether public opinion was in favor of it or not, no matter whether there was objective evidence of its validity or not, this is something comparatively fresh and original. And that, I think, is the heart of the romantic attitude to politics, as I will now try and explain to you. In other words, it's really a kind of Christian attitude which also lays stress on motives, but only because the motives are, so to speak, validated by the belief in the fact that God exists, that Jesus exists, that he said certain things, that there are certain things which are true about man and about God. If this wasn't true, the whole thing, of course, falls to the ground. That's why for Muslims to be doing this sort of thing was perfectly worthless. But by the time you get to the 19th century, you get to the notion of the noble enemy. The noble enemy is better than a vacillating friend. It doesn't matter, you see, that he was an enemy. It doesn't matter that he believes the opposite of what you believe. It doesn't terribly matter what you believe. The important thing is to die for it. In other words, the attitude of mind towards what you are fighting for is of infinitely greater importance than the objective content of what it is you believe. This is brand new. Now, this is all right. This is comparatively harmless when it extends to the world of the arts. And you simply say, someone like, as I say, the ideal human being is someone like a painter or a composer who doesn't look at filthy lucre, who doesn't look at worldly success, who simply listens to the sacred voice within him and does what and tries to make concrete that which it orders him to do. But now, when it applies to politics, certain more sinister consequences follow. Because if you suddenly apply it to politics, you begin saying, well, not only paints, not only sounds are materials out of which works of art can be made, to which a man can dedicate himself, which he can freely determine himself to produce in accordance with an ideal which is sacred because it's his, and not because it's objectively valid, because that's what he's prepared to die for, which is all that matters. This could also apply to political issues. For example, Napoleon. Napoleon bound his spell on the imagination of Europe, not simply because he was a competent soldier, and not because he produced the Code Napoleon, and not because he was a successful emperor of the French, but because he was conceived of as a kind of supreme political artist, a great political creator. Only his material happened to be human beings instead of paints and sounds. And just as the composer is free to mold the sounds in whatever order he pleased, just as the painter is free to do whatever he liked with the colors and paints which he uses, so Napoleon demonstrated that it was possible to take human beings and mold them freely into splendid new combinations. The work, the state suddenly emerges as a work of art. Lots of things have been said about the state before. The state has been regarded as a traffic policeman. The state is regarded as an organic unity, as a full expression of human aspirations. All kinds of things have been said by Aristotle and by St. Thomas, by Hobbes and by Locke, by Rousseau and by others. But the new notion of the state as a work of art rests upon the new model in terms of which the things are explained, the new model being that you create values, you don't find them, you make them. Now, this leads to the view that some human beings are capable of creation and some are not. Those who are capable of creation are, in this view, entitled to use those who are not for the purpose of creating a tremendous work of art out of them. It's true that the people whom Napoleon manipulates may not enjoy it. It's true that if you are a great political creator, you may inflict the most dreadful tortures and pains upon the unfortunate human material which you now mold in the way in which the sculptor molds his clay. But if you aren't capable of creating yourself, you should feel it to be a privilege to be molded, to be tortured, to be knocked into all these shapes by a genius who is about to create a splendid new artistic whole, which is called the new kind of human society. Out of this springs nationalism, for example. If, so long as you confine the notion of the creator to the individual, it, as I say, it remained comparatively harmless. But now people began to say, who is this self who creates? Who is the creator? And some said, but individuals hardly exist. I am what I am because I have been molded by certain forces over which I have no control. Namely, and among them, my fellow human beings. I think in symbols. The symbols in which I think only exist because I communicate with them, with other people. If there was nobody to talk to, I wouldn't have any symbols. And if I had no symbols, I wouldn't think. Therefore, human beings, by definition, are not solitary in the world, not islands, but somehow organically connected with other human beings. The real creative unit is not myself, but something else. Say a race, say a state, say a culture, say a church. And so you get the notion that the true creator is some kind of human group. And to this, the individual must sacrifice himself. And the human group is the artist, itself the artist, which produces shapes as composers produce symphonies and as painters produce pictures. And from this, it's very easy to see how nationalism grows. Because in order to mold my, so that my race or my nation or my establishment should mold itself according to its ideals, I need to do a lot of damage to a lot of other people who unfortunately get in the way. And so you get a fascism too, where you get appointed leaders who are the great artists to whom I willingly submit, because if I cannot be the leader myself, it is something to be allow myself to be the raw material for this splendid artistic creation. This is really the beginning of the whole thing. Now, let me read you some quotations from the apparently harmless writings of Fichte, very few of them, to show you the kind of thing. He says, I don't accept what nature offers because I must, I believe it because I will. And again, if man allows laws to be made for him by the will of others, he reduces himself to a beast, injures his inborn human dignity. Man shall be and do something. Man shall be a quickening source of life, not an echo or an annex, not a piece of driftwood, but someone who determines himself in a certain direction. And from this, the whole romantic theory then proceeds. In other words, that, so to speak, the proper analogy is with the arts and not with the sciences. The important thing is not to know, but to do. Now, it follows from this, if this is true, that, for example, there's no reason for thinking that the various ideals which human beings may adopt will not collide with each other. Once you abandon the view that the answer to the questions how I shall live is in the form of propositions which are true or false for which reasons can be given. Once you abandon the view that there is one true answer to these questions, all the others being false. Once you abandon that, you get into a position where you say these questions are not answered by propositions. These questions are not answered by statements of truths. These questions are answered by action. These questions are answered by artistic creation itself. And then, of course, my artistic creation may come into collision with yours. And so the notion that all the answers must harmonize, and therefore there is a jigsaw puzzle, and there is some kind of ultimate answer, which we may not know, but which somebody knows, such that if only we knew it, we should be able to live our lives harmoniously and be happy and just and good, disappears. And then the notion of tragedy acquires quite a different dimension. Tragedy hitherto is always rests on some kind of error. I do what I do, I kill my father unawares if I'm Oedipus, or I kill my mother Clytemnestra because because she killed my father and so forth, because I'm in a certain state of mind, which on the whole is an erroneous state of mind, the gods have blinded me in a certain way. But if I knew the truth, then I wouldn't be doing these things. In other words, tragedy is always the result of some kind of ignorance, some kind of inability to cope, some sort of defect which in principle is curable. But if ideals are not discoverable, if ideals are made, then this doesn't follow at all. Then it'll follow that it might well be the case that certain valid ideals are not compatible with certain other valid ideals. And here the Romantics showed a certain insight. Because before them, nobody perhaps said what indeed people tend to accept now, that, for example, it may be the case that there are certain ideals which human beings dedicate themselves, which are not compatible with certain other ideals. That, for example, justice is not wholly compatible with mercy. Or that if I know everything, I may not be wholly happy, which was not accepted before. If I know that I have cancer, this will make me less happy than I am now. Or that complete liberty is not compatible with complete equality. Or that complete efficiency is not compatible with a total degree of individual freedom, or whatever it may be. Or that power is not compatible with virtue, and so forth. The idea that there could be ideals, some of which various people could validly seek, which would not be compatible with ideals equally valid, and the tragedy consists in the inevitable conflict of ideals which cannot be squared, whatever you may do. There is a certain logical incompatibility, not just factual, not just resting on temporary ignorance or on curable ignorance, but on the essence of the thing itself, in terms of which certain good things might not be compatible with certain other good things. That is something which I think only emerges after the Romantic movement. Now, the consequences of this are very peculiar in the present day, because if you ask, what do we ourselves believe? Well, supposing I ask you, whom do you put higher in the moral scale? Do you, for example, believe that someone like Frederick the Great, whose motives may have been highly corrupt, who was a cynic, an egomaniac, in ordinary terms, in the ordinary acceptation of the word, a scoundrel, but who undoubtedly made a large number of Germans happier than they were before, made them more efficient, gave them more of what they wanted. Would you say that Frederick the Great is a better man or a worse man than, let us say, someone like Torquemada or somebody? Let's assume that Torquemada was perfectly sincere, but he did torture a lot of innocent persons to death. And then you say, Torquemada's motives are perfectly pure, but the consequences were extremely painful, very disastrous and ruinous. Frederick the Great was, in the ordinary acceptation of the word, a dishonest, crooked, self-seeking, cynical, corrupt man. The consequences of his acts undoubtedly bred order, justice, happiness, and proficiency on the part of a large number of Germans, and probably affected Europe in the most excellent fashion. If you say this to yourself, and you say, well, which of them comes higher? We are confused. Before the 18th century, there would have been no doubt. You had a perfectly objective code. You said those people were better, whose acts conformed to principles, the truth of which was objective and could be discovered by some sort of, proper means, whatever means you regarded as the right means for discovering these truths. By the time when you get to the Romantics, you say there's no doubt at all. Of course, that man is better, who is pure-hearted, who is dedicated, who doesn't calculate, who doesn't reckon, who sacrifices the whole of himself, is prepared to bring himself, if necessary, as a sacrifice to his honorably held beliefs, therefore Torquemada. But now, today, it's not so certain. And you say to yourself, we are, in a sense, heirs of both these points of view. We say, so much for motive, so much for consequence. We must reckon one, and we must reckon the other. And this is a typical, curious, ambiguous condition, which shows how much we've inherited from the Romantic movement. The notion of idealism, for example, the notion that a man may do a lot of harm, but you really shouldn't be too hard on him because his motives are pure, because he meant well, is something which is brand new. The notion, for example, that, as I say, minorities should be protected simply because they are minorities, that martyrs are respectworthy because they are martyrs, even if the things to which they are martyrs seem to you absurd. This is, relatively speaking, new. There are certain insights which the Romantics produced, which undoubtedly did have lingered with us to this day. For example, that men must not be slaughtered to abstract ideals because men create their own ideals. Or the notions which speak that motive counts, as I say, or the notion that purity of heart is important. Or the notion that no objective reasoning, no demonstration that the reality is like this or like that, for example, that there is an inevitable pattern in history, or that it's clear that whatever you may do, the enemy will overwhelm you, therefore it's wiser to submit. That these arguments are not decisive, provided that you have some kind of private ideal of your own to which you are prepared to sacrifice your life, that in some way nobler, to go to certain defeat, provided you are quite clear that this is what your life is dedicated to, than to scrap your ideal simply in order to ally yourself with the big battalions of history. That is something which the Romantics, we have inherited in the Romantics. The thing which, of course, the Romantics have also left us, the evil part of their heritage, if I may call it that, is, of course, the notion that there are no common goods. The notion, so to speak, that everyone simply determines himself to act whatever way he wishes. The kind of enormities which were practiced by whoever it might be, fascists, communists, whoever it might be, produced certain qualms, produced resistance, produced a sense of shock and horror on the part of the people on whom they were inflicted, suddenly became a demonstration that there does, after all, exist a certain core, if you like, of common values which human beings accept in most places, most times, I won't say everywhere all the time, but in most places, most times, in terms of which alone they are able to communicate with each other. In other words, if I say to somebody, why do you think it's wrong to bear false witness? Or why do you think it wrong to punish innocent victims, which most people in most times have certainly thought extremely wrong? It's then artificial to say, because I've determined myself in that direction, I might just as well have chosen the opposite. But I happen to believe in this. This is my particular work of art. I happen to be an impressionist painter. You happen to be a cubist painter. If you believe the opposite, you believe the opposite. I happen to believe this. You believe that. And there is no common ground between us. This is not so. Broadly speaking, you could say that if you found a human being, all of whose moral convictions were such that it was impossible to communicate with him, if you found a human being as in Hume's example, who was prepared to destroy the entire world in order to cure a pain in his little finger. If you discovered this human being, you wouldn't say, he has a different code from me. He has committed himself to a different ideal from me. He happens to be an existentialist who doesn't believe that there are metaphysical guarantees of anything, who simply believes in gratuitously committing himself to a certain form of life, the reason for which is that he has committed himself, and there can be no other reason. You wouldn't say that. You would say a man who's prepared to destroy the world in order to cure a pain in his little finger is certifiable. And if you said that, you would mean that by a normal human being, you would regard a human being who did not accept these values. That part of what you mean by a human being is a certain common core of moral beliefs which most human beings, whatever their political or moral convictions might be, accept. And that unless they have these convictions, communication with them is impossible. And on the whole, we define human beings to some degree in terms of being able to be communicated with. And this, in some sense, demonstrates that these so-called moral and political values are not arbitrary in the sense in which the Romantics wish to make them. When they are arbitrary, they're not called moral. We don't dispute matters of taste. There we think it's all right for different people to have different tastes. It doesn't shock us. We think manners can be different. We think customs can be different. But the things about which we do not believe the differences can be too wide, though we recognize some, we specifically for that reason call moral. And we call them moral precisely because there is an implication that to be a human being at all is to accept certain forms of life, to accept, if you like, certain principles, in terms of which alone any human being can understand any other human being. And this is the ultimate core of what might be called a natural law doctrine, although it can be interpreted in a very empirical and very sociological fashion. But there is no doubt that the Romantic movement made a big dent in the somewhat naive acceptance of this view before the 18th century. Namely, the point about the Romantic movement is that it forever impressed upon the imagination of mankind the idea that too many rules, too many principles really didn't bind mankind, that there were exceptional persons. That in some sense, if you asked a man why he behaved as he behaved, if he answered, because this is my ideal, because this is what I want to dedicate my life to, because that's how life looks to me, because this is what I am, so to speak, this is the way in which I look at the world, this is what is sacred to me, this is that for the sake of which I am prepared to fight and if need be die. If a man says that, what he's saying is not absurd. Whereas I think before 1750, you would certainly have thought it absurd. You would have thought it as absurd as saying, twice two is seven, something for which I'm prepared to die. And that is because you do not think that truth in moral matters and truth in political matters is the same sort of thing as truth in scientific matters or truth in factual matters. And this particular proposition, and whatever its implications may be, I think the Romantics have in a certain sense established even in our consciousnesses. And this, I think, is an enormous shift in the European consciousness. The fact that we do pay attention to motive. The fact that we do think that sincerity and integrity are virtues in themselves is something new. I don't say it's good, I don't say it's bad. I merely wish to impress upon you that the whole cluster of virtues, idealism, integrity, dedication, all these words which we use so easily, the word creative, which has become one of the most hackneyed words in the language, and which has practically come to mean nothing at all now, these words were brought into the world by the enormous shift in consciousness which the Romantic Revolution induced, and which, in some sense, seems to me to have altered the attitudes and the actions of human beings, perhaps forever. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, at the end of this fascinating and original development of the great differences between the age of reason and the age of romanticism, Sir Isaiah has consented to answer questions that you care to propose to him from the floor.
I'm so sorry, I can't quite hear. Could you? I don't think that Romanticism ever fell down. I don't think it ever fell down. I think it went on. I think realism was a kind of reaction against the exaggerations of Romanticism. I mean, the exaggerations of people who wanted to assert themselves at all costs. The essence of Romanticism, I suppose, consisted in human beings who said, I am what I am, I choose what I choose. Whether I'm Napoleon conquering Russia, or I'm a man wearing a red waistcoat and leading a crab leading a lobster on a lead in Paris, and painting my hair green, which is what some romantics in Paris certainly did. The whole purpose of all this was to say, I'm a free chooser of what I want. I'm an authentic man. I'm not drifting. I don't accept other people's judgments. I don't live as I live because I assume that other people's truths are true. I challenge everything and determine myself in accordance with my own subjective will. That was Romanticism. Well, realism is, I suppose, in some sense, was a revolt against the view that this is, in fact, a correct view of human nature, so to speak, that most human beings were that. The main achievement, certainly, of the realistic novel is an attempt to analyze human beings in terms of motives and in terms of behavior, which is conditioned, which is induced in them by factors over which they haven't very much control, and which, on the contrary, in some sense, demonstrate that they belong to the world of nature, to some extent, and behave to the world, so to speak, of nature, that they are acted upon by the same kind of causes as natural objects are, to a greater extent than the Romantics maintained. But the Romanticism was never completely overthrown, never, even to this day. I mean, if you ask what existentialism is, existentialism is pure modern romanticism. Existentialists say men try and justify their conduct by pleading various metaphysical or theological truths. All these truths are illusion. Men try and justify their conduct by pleading alibis, by saying God told them to do this, or the universe is like this, or these are objective principles which one has to follow. There are no such principles. These are merely attempts by human beings to shift responsibility. Men are what they are. They determine themselves as they determine themselves, and they might as well face this fact. This is a pure romantic position, in which you say, what is your motive for doing this? My motive for doing it is that I commit myself to this particular course of action. And you, who don't commit yourself, are really, in a certain sense, by the very non-commitment, commit yourself to drifting along with the others. And this is no less a commitment than my conscious commitment. All you are doing is simply allowing yourself to drift with the others, which in a way is a tacit commitment to being pushed about by external causes. This is a straight romantic position, and not at all unknown in the present, I would say. So that I don't know if I've answered your question correctly. To suppose there was a thing called romanticism which was knocked out by realism in a kind of duel is certainly historically not correct. I think they march side by side as sort of rival and incompatible views.
The gentleman down here.
Well, I think it's too flat a way of putting it. I think there's a truth in that. But I think modified is too weak. I mean, I think that in a way, you see, when people discard one model and use another, for the time being, you certainly feel as the old model was no good at all, a kind of straitjacket, and you feel the new model is something very liberating and splendid. And you use the new model for all you are worth. You say mechanism is a ridiculous way of describing society, organism is the thing. Well, then after you've used it for a bit, organism also appears to block out certain aspects of experience, and you apply it to something, you use something else again. I don't think they exactly modify. I think what happens is human beings oscillate between one model and another, sometimes using one, sometimes using another. At certain very extreme and fanatical persons use only one model at a time. Most human beings have a large number of, well, perhaps not a large number, but a number of not wholly compatible ways of explaining life, which overlap with one another, but don't exactly modify each other. It's exactly like human beings who follow several ideals at the same time, hoping they won't clash. If they do clash, they don't know what to do. That's what's called a condition of moral agony. And this is what happens to countries. You see, when a country follows a certain kind of model in its experience, something dreadful happens. I mean, they have a huge economic crisis, or they're attacked by the enemy, or something of the sort. Then suddenly their ideals are switched, and they feel uncomfortable because they don't wish to abandon the old, they can't not follow the new, they oscillate uncomfortably in between, and they try and marry them. These things prove very seldom, they prove very unmarriageable as a rule. And so, like most human beings, we try and hope that these things will harmonize, and if not, do our best. But it isn't quite modification, that. It isn't, modification implies a sort of peaceful process of assimilation, which I don't think is what happens.
There's a young man just here.
If we were to classify Marxism within the categories of early 18th century rationalism as a contrast to early 19th century romanticism,
mm-hmm. Which category would I put Marxism in? Oh, well, yes, it's a perfectly reasonable question. Marxism, Hegel and Marx both were, of course, extreme anti-romantics. And what they wished to do was to put humanity on the rails again. That is roughly what happened. That's to say, you have people dashing off in all directions, people following their own whims or following their own private ideals, which means there are no objective values. The old objective values in the 18th century are plainly discredited, largely by the failure of the French Revolution, not so much by being refuted, as so much as because the French Revolution was made in their name, it was a fearful failure, and this automatically discredited the official ideals in terms of which it was made. And so there's an attempt to say, but there is objective reality about certain moral political positions. This is what mankind is like. Mankind is a body of men divided into classes. These classes clash. The clash of classes produces the following consequences. You belong to one class or another. Your life is likely to be modified in the following fashion. Your moral ideas and your political ideas are conditioned by the class to which you belong. Therefore, the proper thing for a rational being who wishes to live his life in a non-self-frustrating, a non-self-defeating way is to understand what reality is like. Reality isn't what these other people said it was. Reality is not static. Reality isn't like nature. It's like a battlefield of a certain kind. I, Marx, will teach you what reality is like. And when you've learned that, it'll be mad not to live accordingly. In other words, he still belongs to the category of people who say, if you know what things are like, you cannot help adjusting yourself to it. Whereas for the romantics, no amount of knowledge will prevent you from doing whatever it is you determine yourself to do. Knowledge by itself doesn't help. So that Marx is a strict anti-romantic whose whole position is to try and reconstitute some kind of objective ground of political action by explaining what history is like, by explaining how rational beings are to avoid suicide, something of that kind.
Several, I think, there are.
But more by ideals or? Like all human beings, a little bit of both. My whole position was that we're the helpless victims of two incompatible theories.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are two things there. There are two things there. Kant certainly didn't think life was art. Certainly not. At no point did he think that. And it is, of course, a false belief, as far as I can see, and he was right not to think it. I mean, it was an extraordinary romantic aberration. I don't wish to defend it. Art is art, life is life. And the proposition that life is art merely means that it's a new analogy, a new image, which certainly produced fructifying results, but as with all these similes, once it became pushed a little too far, once it became blinding to human beings, produced distortions. But the point about Kant, there are two things about Kant. One is the point you made, that he would have disapproved of Napoleon because, since human beings create values, to slaughter human beings, to anything is wrong, because if you can only slaughter what is lower to the higher. Since the highest thing there is the individual and his values, to say that human beings should die for something which is invented for them by other human beings implies that these first human beings do not possess, are not themselves creators of values, but are obliged to be sacrificed to values created by others. In other words, there are some people who are privileged creators of values and others not, roughly speaking. Some people know what the proper ends are and others do not know and therefore must obey the ones who do, which is a hierarchical principle which he denies, of course. All men are equal in respect of being followers of those values which they themselves create and may therefore not be sacrificed to anything whatever except the values they do create, something of that kind. The second proposition about Kant is that he did think that all rational men must believe the same. This is precisely what the Romantics denied. Why he believed it is another matter, but he did think anybody placed in a certain situation, if he was rational, would certainly believe the answer to problem of moral conduct to be exactly the same. Therefore, it could not in principle be the case that given the same question facing two different individuals, they could, if they were both rational, give different answers. And in this respect, he belongs to the pure classical old sort of pre-romantic tradition, that there are objective answers. Only for him, the answers are not given by inspecting nature. For him, the answers are given by inspecting some kind of inner non-empirical self or something of the sort. But he is fully in the pre-romantic tradition in supposing that there are objective answers binding upon all men in the same situation. This is exactly what the Romantics denied, precisely. So that is why he would have been outraged by the use inevitably made of his own principles.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to call the meeting to an end now. Sir Isaiah has given us a feast which I know will provide sustenance for us for many a season. Thank you for coming, and thank you, Sir Isaiah.